guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the Technet and Limelock, as we've done for lots of years. As you know, the main purpose of the Technet is education. Amateurs gather here who are curious and willing to share information with each other as to how their radio equipment works, how to make it work better, how to fix things, how to understand things, and so on. So we share information. Been around for 35 years, and under one leadership, which we believe is some kind of a record, the flea market had the field day with this particular weekend. I suspect that because some of those guys have stayed up all night long. Let me drop it. Some of them will be sleeping right now, but a little later on, I'm going to ask you guys to give me your impression of the field day operation that you visited, or multiple operations that you visited. What did you like, and what did you see? Who did you talk to? So we'll be doing some of that later on. We're going to be taking check-ins from people who have a question or comment. Stand by a minute. People who are going to check in right now are going to give me their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 35 years, we believe someone is listening, and that doesn't have to be confirmed anymore. And try to give me your name. Most people forget to do that. So call letters and name. A typical sign-in would sound like this. KC2, TTT, Tim, and yes. So give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe from Harrison, New York. And, yes.
W2RIY, Joe.
Yes.
WA2SAY, Doug. Yes.
KC1 SAM. Sam, yes.
AC2IS, Bill, yes.
Well done, you guys. Okay, Joe number one, QYW. Joe number two, RYY. SAY, Doug. Who used to be called Tony DB McGarrett. Story behind that. Sam, KC1 SAM. Bill, AC2IS. Okay, good sign in. Anyone else that wants to give us a call letters and name because they do have a question or a comment for the net, give it to me right now. K2RIW listening.
WS2N Paul with the base report. Good evening, Dick.
And out of curiosity, Paul, did you get a chance to visit one of the, or did you participate or visit one of the field day operations?
This year I stayed home and I operated as one Delta, so plenty of contact, but from home, back to you.
Okay, we'll be hearing about that a little bit later. Okay, KC2QIW, Joe number one. Go right ahead with your question or comment. You got it, Joe.
Yeah, how you doing, buddy? My question is about amplifiers. It could do with radio equipment amplifiers, or even amplifiers with music. Okay, Dick, so my question to you is, I noticed that the Class H amplifiers are a lot heavier than the Class D amplifiers. I was wondering the difference between the classes, and what do they mean when they say Class H in amplifiers, or Class D might be digital, or maybe necessary, not to. And then they also have a Class A and B, but I'm just focusing on the D and the H class amplifiers. Back to you, Dick.
WB2HWW, is Echo Link working tonight?
Is Echo Link working tonight? Stand by. Okay, I'm seeing the fact that the 975-375 machine is working with a little bit of delay, which means that it's being hooked up by an internet connection. Usually when the two machines are working, Echolink is also working. Do you have reason to believe Echolink is not working? Go ahead.
I'm not hearing anything off of it. All right, Dick, I just got a quick question. I want to ask you a question about matching transformers. And I just want to check something because I think I'm misunderstanding something. So if you want to put me on the first for the runway, I want to ask you about a quarter wave piece of coax and the impedance at the other end, all right?
Very fine, Howie. Okay, that's a good question. We'll get to you. So quarter wave, piece matching, transformer.
Repeater, time out.
So-called impedance inverter device. All right, getting back to Joe number one's question. The so-called linear amplifiers, class A, B, and C. By linear, I mean some portion of the waveform of the original signal is being reproduced in a quasi-linear manner. An amplifier that's biased so that it conducts 100% of the time, class A, is the most linear, and it's the lowest in efficiency. Class B conducts roughly 50% of the time, and class B is usually used in push-pull. Two separate transistors, one conducts on the positive half cycle, the other one conducts on the negative half cycle, and when the two are combined, you produce a beautiful sine wave with a considerably higher efficiency than class A. That's class B push-pull. Class C, which is only used for CW, you can't transmit a sideband or any other kind of linearized signal with class C, but class C has the highest efficiency, 70% and higher above, and class C quite often conducts a very small percentage of the time, just the upper positive half of the waveform, or positive 20% of the waveform conducts in class C, and it produces rich harmonics, but your output filter supposedly only passes the fundamental and rejects all the other harmonics. That's class C. Stand by. Now we get into the more digital modes. Class D is where, on the upper half cycle, the amplifier conducts continuously, full blast, and the lower half of the cycle, it doesn't conduct at all. And it's producing a square wave. And a square wave can be produced with a 90% and above efficiency. That's the good news. But a class C, a square wave, has got a hell of a lot of energy on all of the odd harmonics. Third, fifth, and seventh harmonic is a lot of energy. And so with some fancy filtering, class D can give you a very high efficiency amplification on a CW-like signal. Class D is not going to reproduce single sideband very well. Not at all. So for Morse code, class D, and there's now a whole series of digital-like modes, class D, E, E, F, G, H, and I, where in some cases it is a kind of amplifier running at a carrier rate much higher than the actual frequency reproduced. There's a kind of audio amplifier which is producing a square wave in the output transistors. Let me drop.
Took care of that electric.
Thank you, Eric. So Echolink is back in operation. It was discontinued for a little bit. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, the computer has some issues, but I'll fix it after we're finished. But it's running right now.
Right now, Eric, I can get into it.
Yeah, you should be able to try.
And I want to drop. I'm using RF right now. I'm on my remote base. All right. Let me see if I can get into it so I can drop my repeater off this thing.
That's working as well.
There was a type of audio amplifier where the output transistors are switching in a push-pull manner with square wave, and they're switching at, let's say, a 40 or a 50 kilohertz rate. And now, by changing the pulse width modulation, in other words, push-pull transistors if they transmit 55% positive square wave and 45% negative square wave, and you put that through a low-pass filter, you'll get a positive signal, a positive voltage coming out. So by modulating the pulse width of the square waves being produced at a very high rate, like 40 or 50 kilohertz, you can now have an audio amplifier by way of its filter producing beautiful high-fidelity audio at near 100% efficiency, regardless of whether the signal you're producing is a low-level, medium-level, or high-level audio signal. So that's a kind of, I'm not quite sure what they call it, class D, E, F, one of those names. So when you start getting into the letters higher than C, when the classes of amplification are above class C, the quasi-square wave, quasi-digital, there's various ways of doing it, where various ways of filtering out the odd and even harmonics and so on, but they're all being done for higher efficiency. One other kind of amplifier when it comes to high efficiency is the so-called Dougherty amplifier, which really is a linear audio amplifier followed by another amplifier that only cuts in for high-level signals, and an elaborate filtering network that allows it to take place. But I think it was QST Magazine. In the QST Magazine in the last couple of months did have an article on showing you a little bit of what's going on with class D, E, F, G, and H, and I, if you know what I mean. So if you Google those words, class D, class E, class F, class G, class H amplifier, Google will give you a lot of information on this. So they're all being done for, the first priority is higher efficiency, the second priority in some cases is higher linearity when it's done just right. So there's a zillion of those that have been invented in the last decade or two, Joe. KC2, QIW. I know you didn't get a complete answer, but at least you got a little more information about it. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Hey, Roger, Roger. Yeah, of course. I'll look more into it, and thank you for the information. I'll, you know, when I get a chance, I'll Google it. But, yeah, I just sold my my class 8 amplifier, and then I picked up a class D. And I noticed that the class D amplifier is only, like, about, like, 11 pounds. And the class 8 amplifier was about 45 pounds. Yeah, I noticed that. These amplifiers that I'm talking about is for music only, you know. And I think my amateur radio amplifier is a class A and B, push and pull, I believe. But, yeah, I'll get back to you with the A and B one. I think that's what it is for the amateur radio. But yeah, thank you for the help. Thank you.
How many watts of audio output on those two amplifiers that you were talking about, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, Roger. With my studio setup over here, I picked up a nice, beautiful QSC with like a DSP window interface, and I only use it for like 4 ohms. So it does about continuous 600 watts into 4 ohms. Because I always use double woofer speakers with the titanium horns. Now with the radio amateur equipment, I put in like 15 watts into the amateur amplifier, and I get close to 400 watts out of the amateur radio equipment. And this amplifier that I'm using is a RM Italy automatic solid state for HF amplifier, and it works really good. I actually bought one that's straight from Italy. Yeah, so back to you.
Yeah, there were two amplifiers you were telling me that were two different weights. I believe both of those were audio amplifiers, and one of them, I think you told me, produced 600 watts. Did each one of them run at roughly the 600 watt level, the heavy one and the light one? Go ahead, Joe.
Comment
WD2HW.
Yeah,
wait, hold on. Let me see who has it. I think I have it. Yeah, I'm sorry, Sam. Yeah, the ones I was talking about, the weight, yeah, they both do the same, wattage, 600 continuous on 4 ohms. And I noticed that the Class D is a lot lighter. So I guess maybe because the power supply is different than the Class H. So they both have the same specs, 600 continuous for the studio setup. Back to you.
Yeah, to produce 600 watts with a 4 ohm speaker is quite a few volts. So the differences in those amplifiers is that one of them probably has, or maybe both of them have, the raw power supply, could be a switching type power supply, and the actual audio output is another, basically a pulse width modulated switching power supply. And so by switching power supplies, you can in many cases avoid transformers, produce tremendous amounts of powers at very high efficiency with very light equipment. If you are using a conventional tube-type amplifier with 5880 tubes or 6146 tubes or 807-type tubes, audio amplifier, 600 watts, my goodness, the heat in that room would be fierce. That amplifier would fill up a rack. So we've come a long way with these switching techniques. How we may have some familiarity with them. Some of these switching light techniques for high power audio amplification. He's going to give us some of those words right now. WB2HWW, T2RW. Go ahead, Howie.
All right, kids. The comment I was going to make is you forgot to talk about AB1, where they're doing less than 180 degrees, and you can bias them. In those types of situations, you've got to worry about the crossover distortion, and you can use tremendous feedback. I'm not that up on the new Class B and H. I'm an old-timer, buddy.
Very fine, Howie. Was there another person that want to make a comment? Give me your call letters. T2RW, that name, T2RW.
Hey, you do, Eric.
Go right ahead, Eric.
The one thing I wanted to point out, first of all, Class D requires a reasonable amount of filtering because of a harmonic energy. And essentially, classes E, F, G, and H actually are all similar to Class D, or rather E and F, similar to Class D, and E and H look a little bit more like AB. But, and then there's a Class G, which, well, it kind of goes, it's sort of a little bit like a Doherty amplifier in a sense that it's, the peak voltage is generally higher than the supply voltage, so, you know, there's some inductive stuff going on. There's issues with distortion, things like that, and crossover, but the key to all these more efficient amplifiers is filtering, whereas the Class H amplifier is really heavy because if it's like something from JBL or those folks, they tend to use big, heavy transformers at the output as part of their filter network, but also it kind of gives it the resonance or the tonal quality, and I think I have to drop it. Hang on. It's sort of modeled after, the sound is sort of like what you get out of a Macintosh amplifier with the 6883s in the output. But in essence, they're switching transistors that are going at high speed, really looking for zero crossings to make the audio in the end. So it's an interesting way of doing things. There are audible artifacts in the D. Depends upon how it's been designed, but JBL makes some really good ones. They make these 1500 watt amplifiers that are actually built into the speaker cabinet, so you know, it's real lightweight. They're all based on switching supplies and nothing heavy in it, whereas a lot of the Class G and H's have real output transformers which adds to the weight. And sometimes they use linear supply for whatever reason. I have no idea, but that's just the audio world. K2RIW, K2HX. And that's really something.
Did you hear my last comment on AB1 amplifiers?
Yes, Howie, we heard your comment on AB1 amplifiers. Stop worrying. We heard your comment on AB1 amplifiers, Howie. 1,500 watts amplifier built inside of the speaker cabinet. Wow. That is a pretty strong demonstration, Eric, of a rather high efficiency, rather low heat output, and still a lot of audio output.
That's the size of the speaker that takes the power.
Now, give us some words on that, the size of the speaker and the size of the enclosure. How heavy was that thing? And is it all running on 240 volts supply as far as raw power? Go ahead.
Oh, runs on 120. The speaker cabinet, rather heavy because it's wood. And they're really designed to be in a theater. I've used an awful lot of them. We hang them up as the main set of speakers, especially if we're creating a 5.1 situation. They make a series of speakers that have all the same characteristics, so the things that you use for the sides of the back are considerably smaller. They're not 1,500 watts like the main, or they're like 600 to 800 watts. So an audio file, which, you know, for what I can hear, I'm not the best one to tell you about the response, but what I get from other people with full range of hearing, they're absolutely fascinated by it.
On 115, 120 volt raw power going into that speaker, amplifier, enclosure, and thing. Rarely do we use more than 15 amperes on a 120 volt line. That's therefore around 1800 raw watts going in. And if you're getting 1500 audio watts out, obviously the amplifier is running at, or amplifier plus its power supply is running at ridiculously high efficiency. So that's got to be a digital mode. Anything with a Class A amplification running at 50% efficiency would, in that case, need more than 3,000 watts, 3,500, 4,000 watts going in, so to speak. So we're coming a long way with solid-state amplifiers and switching techniques. And so I'm getting the impression, Eric, that in your industry, in the broadcast industry, a hell of a lot of the RF amplification, audio amplification, speakers, loudspeakers, and whatever. A high percentage of it these days is rather digital switching techniques as far as power supply and even the real signal being amplified. I'm getting the impression that pure Class A amplification is becoming more and more rare in your industry. Is that roughly true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, detect that.
On one hand, yes, and on the other hand, no. Consider the fact that our TV transmitters, especially doing the HBSB stuff, now, you know, you can't use Class B. You could use Class AB with a certain level of problems, but most of your digital transmitters are either Class A or a form of Doherty amplifier, which is Class A and Class C at the same time.
Yeah, Doherty is the one where you've got a main signal going through the center of the amplifier in the Class A mode. Off to one side, you've got this amplifier that just handles peak envelope power. When you get a demand for more power, that thing cuts in, and sometimes it's Class C. And so the Doherty can give you overall increase in efficiency, and you're not drawing Class A bias current on all those gauges all the time when they're sitting there running idle. So it's a pretty classy technique to make the way that high-power amplifier cuts in. I'm guessing it takes some pre-distortion and some other fancy techniques to make that a clean switch over to the high-power peak mode. Is that true, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's interesting the way they have the bias set up on that. You got to consider when you're doing peak envelope power. And my phone's ringing. Hang on, let me answer this. I'll be right back.
Yeah. He's in the broadcast studio right now. Obviously, he's getting the alarm that something is going on. Okay, we're going to go over to Joe in the meantime. W2RYY. Over to you, Joe. K2LAW in the tech net.
Well, you may need your broadcast to answer this question. When they start moving DTV channels around, and they start moving some stations to the lower VHF part of the spectrum in the New York City area, my question is going to be, are they going to be running enough power to overcome local line noise? I'll give you an example of what had happened last Monday after the TechNet. The Bain was open. It opened around noon, 1 o'clock or something like that. And I was using my spectrum analyzer, and I was looking at channels RF4 and RF5. And I could see carriers coming up that were very, very strong. 4 never come up high enough for me to see it. It wasn't Atlantic City. It was another station. So I was pointing about 292 degrees. But channel 5 did come up for about 30 seconds to maybe 45 seconds, and it disappeared. And I didn't get the header information on it as far as call it is. Well, the header information said was SON space LIF. So that didn't do me much good, but I looked in the FCC database for stations along that line towards Chicago and further out. But anyway, my question is going to require some sort of power be transferred, a decent amount of power in these stations, because the local line noise I see, like especially when this station came in, let me do a reset. Got my TOT set up 89 seconds, so I wouldn't time out. The signal had to approach and get stronger than minus 50 dBm. You know what frequency of carrier I'm looking at, the bottom edge of the band. I was pretty much tuned in on that. And that had to get up at 50 or above before the picture would start pixelating and actually locking me lock up. Anything before that won't lock up at all. The only channel out of New York right now that I see all the time on RF3 is the one that gives me a channel carrier power of about minus 45 dBm. The one on channel 2, whatever the low power channel that is, it's like minus 70, 60, 70, 75, something like that on an average. Never see the picture unless the band opens up. So this got me kind of curious who's going to get shuffled around down there and if they're going to have a lot of issues with local power line noise, because it seems to be something that's continuous in my area.
Yeah, I'm going to assume that Eric has come back with us. And Eric, after the new switchover to the new television system takes place in the next few years, will they be using all of the lower VHF channels, channel 2 through 6? And one of the things that Eric is concerned about is that we do periodically get arcing power line noise, which in the old days of analog television would give you two bars of noise that slowly walked across the screen. And so how tolerant will the new television system be? But will we be using, in the metro areas like New York City, channels 2, 4, 5, and 6? KE2EJ, if you're there, Eric. K2RYW in the tech net.
K2RYW, KE2EJ. Well, as you know, a lot of TV stations sold their UHF frequencies. Some of them actually chose to go to channel 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. In New York, you currently have a RF channel 3. And, you know, it's funny. All the folks that I talk to that watch channel 3 directly off the air, including out past where you are, they seem pretty happy with it. They're, you know, you'd expect a certain amount of power line noise to cause problems with ADS-B. Whereas when we go to the COFDM, that becomes less of a problem. It's still a problem, but nowhere near as bad as what we've got with ADS-B at this point. But, for those that are watching Channel 3 here, they don't seem to have the issues of, you know, airplanes going by, causing multipaths and things like that. And there's a bunch of stations out in Texas that are really happy with being on Channel 2, being able to get the reach that they get out of it, which is better than what they were doing on UHF. So, you know, there's a lot of plus and minuses. But as far as New York goes, we'll kind of be Channel 12, Channel 11, Channel 7, and the Channel 8 in New Jersey, that's not far away. We got Channel 3, there's a low power on Channel 2, I don't know if it's going to stay there. And then I'm uncertain about 4 and 5, but I think I actually have to look. I think there's one in Connecticut, and then there's a 4, I think, in Pennsylvania, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I've also noticed that what's advertised as Channel 33, which RF-wise is really Channel 3, and I think it's coming from 4 Times Square. I think they're running some pretty high power. Channel 3 in the analog days used to give me a lot of line noise. I'm guessing that line noise is still there, but there's something about the 8VSD that doesn't see it, and therefore I get very high reliability out of what's called Channel 33. So I guess they're giving us a strong signal, and that 8VSD is not as line noise vulnerable as I used to think it was. So what's magic about Channel 3? It is coming from 4 Times Square, isn't that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW.
WD2HWW with a question on this subject.
Yeah, they come from 4 Times Square. As will I be coming from 4 Times Square on occasion, and let's see, who else? ABC is up on 4 Times Square. Currently they're operating out of Empire, but they're back up to 4 Times Square. WNYE, which is RF-24, but it's branded as 25, that's coming from 4 Times Square, and they're not going anywhere, so. And 47, which is NJU, which is RF, I forget, but they're currently coming from a temporary antenna on the World Trade Center.
Go ahead with your question, Howie.
Sorry for taking a second to tee up with Ethelink. Question, this is for Eric. How reliable or how immune are the radio or the TV receivers today compared to the older ones? Will 6 meters be a problem? I do some 6 meter operations, and I am wondering, now that we're going to get more digital 6 meter, low band TV, is that going to create any noise for the 6 meter band? For a while, 6 got very quiet because of the fact that we didn't have Channel 2 and we didn't have much control. I could operate 6 meter sideband or whatever and not really have a problem. So I'm curious, how acceptable will the interference be? Obviously, the people won't know who's interfering, but you know, it's not analog, so I'm curious to that. Go ahead.
All right, Howie. Well, as you may be aware of, when you are operating analog TV, okay, it is VSD. And where the edge of the band is, it rolls off by, is it, I remember what the value is, it's been so long. But it rolls off kind of slowly, so there's not necessarily harmonic energy, but you being where you are, you know, being close to Empire, even World Trade in the past, and actually Channel 2 would operate sometimes from Empire. Even though it rolls off at the rate that the FCC specifies, there's still a lot of energy that rolls down towards 50 megahertz that would affect you in terms of what you were hearing on 6 meters. The new stuff is extremely sharp filtered. It actually fits in the 6 megahertz slot, and if you want to calculate the harmonics, they don't exactly fall into the 50 to 54 megahertz range, unless, of course, you've got something else that's doing some mixing nearby. So as we go to the newer forms of transmission in New York, I'm looking, I think you're really going to have to worry about that. The low power station is there. It's probably imperceivable to you on your on the receiver for 50 megahertz. But, yeah, with the digital stuff, you're not going to run into the same thing as when you had the analog stations running, you know, CPO out of the transmitter at 24 or 30 kilowatts, and then the gain in the antenna, which is usually around 3 to 5 or 6 dB. So, it's much less of a concern today than it would be, you know, 20 years ago. Will we have the equivalent of a tracking RF front end, tracking filter, on the new television sets? You did with your turret type channel switching arrangement of the old analog television receivers. You had a quasi bandpass RF filter, and you would tune the channel to, I guess, they probably made that filter not 6 megs wide, but more like 10 megs wide, so it didn't cut off the edges. And I guess that was part of the problem of how a 50 megacycle amateur radio signal came roaring through the front end of those sets and gave a lot of grief. The new sets, which are going to have all three standards built in, analog, ATSB, COFDM, all digitally commandable, so to speak, I'm sure it'd be nice if they had a tracking filter in the front end. I'm a little worried that the front end RF bandwidth may be similar to the old days, and therefore we could be getting a blocking condition from our ham radio operator on 50 megacycles. You may have some words on all this, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW in the tech net.
Right to SA1 with a comment.
WK2J. What I was just referring to is the TV station making the noise floor of 50 to 54 megahertz be not so quiet. Looking at it from the other perspective, I don't know if I sent you, I think I sent you an article with one of the guys that is pretty much the RF guru for a lot of the broadcast industry, has done front end measurements of the current receivers and the ones that are coming. No, there's no tracking filter at the front end. If you're going to swamp it with 50 megahertz, the TV's going to stop working. It's pretty much, you know, you overload the front end, the IP3 products are just going to kill you and it'll go away. So, as far as channel 3 goes, you know, again, if you whack the front end and you saturate it, you're going to wind up with the same thing. But there are issues of, because we're able to run things adjacent channel, there are harmonic relationships that have been mapped out in many places, which is supposedly taken into consideration by the software that decided who's going to be on what channel. Now that we're going to, since they've sold frequencies and everybody has to be squeezed together. So, in the real world, as opposed to in the lab, that has yet to be seen, because currently we don't actually have real adjacent channels, but there are a couple, but they're not emanating, they're emanating from the same place. But there's a couple of situations where emanating from different physical locations, and some of the receivers actually have a problem with it. Today's receivers, though, the IF filtering is really good.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We only lost the last 10 seconds there. Stand by. Doug recognized, I'm going to get to you next. The television reception in 1970, for instance, I think 95% of the population watched over-the-air broadcast television. And they had some relatively wide front ends with not a great deal of filtering. And so a ham radio operator in 6 meters created a lot of grief. Today, I'm guessing 98% of the population is watching something that is the equivalent of cable television. As such, the system is thoroughly shielded, pretty much the first 80 dB of shielding, so to speak, from the ham radio operator on 6 meters next door. That's a huge advantage that we now have. That I think will allow the guys who are interested in the magic band, as it's called, the 6 meter ham radio band, where almost every mode of propagation in the world
happens at some time there. I think we'll have a lot of hams going back to 6 meters who were afraid of it in the past. W-H-O-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W, there with your comment, Doug.
Yeah, Dick, I think you kind of hit on it already, both of you guys, because if I remember, and I used to operate 6 meters a long time ago back in the 60s, and the main problem was always fundamental overload. I mean, you didn't have a problem from a guy a block away. You had a problem with a guy next door, or maybe next door to him, or behind your house. But that was where the problems were. It was fundamental overload. It was not really, I don't think it was too much you could, you know, they didn't build the kind of filters you really need to get rid of that.
If you whack the front end, it's gone. And the so-called low-pass filter we could buy in those days did help somewhat. But there were very few of those these days, and they're not needed anymore because just about everybody's on cable television.
I think they don't.
You do some surveys on this, Eric. When it comes to the people who live within, let me pick a number, 10 miles of Empire, 15 miles of Empire, a high percentage of those people who are not top of the economic ladder don't think they can afford cable TV, and they're watching over-the-air broadcast television on their rabbit ears in their house. But I think that's only 5 or 10% of your total television watching audience. The people that are out at my range, I think 98% of them are on the equivalent of cable or satellite. Correct me on those numbers, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. You know what? I think I just sent you the latest demographics of over-the-air TV. The numbers are considerably higher. Well, where you are and further out, what you're saying is true. I don't think it's 98. There are, you know, it's in the 90s. I'm not going to argue with that. But as you get closer to the city, of course, then that number drops rapidly. There are actually real numbers that I can send to you that help you understand where over-the-air television is happening. And also, as you go into other parts of the country, because we're in a very densely populated area, as you go to Texas, as you go to Wyoming or Iowa or even Oklahoma, you'll find out there's way more antennas than you could ever imagine, simply because it's too expensive to build cable systems over these wide swaths of area. You hear the government talking about making the internet available to a lot of the country. That's simply because it ain't wired. And you'll find more TV antennas in places where there's copper for the phone line, so they're not buying internet service and TV service from a cable system like you would along with your phone. So depends upon where you are, the demographics of where you are, and also the geographics of wherever you are. So, you know, it's great to think that everybody's on cable, but when you add up the number of cable subscribers from all the cable companies versus the number of TV sets or TV homes that are out there, there's a big difference.
Y? Something like 2RY. Give us the full set of call letters and your name and your question or comment. Go right ahead, sir.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
These are things of the past. I think there's even more internet TV with an internet connection and a box, which enables a person to stream or download material from the internet. And it looks like a lot of people watch TV on their computers. Go ahead.
Okay, we missed the beginning of your conversation because you picked up before waiting for the four beeps, and you timed out, so we don't know who you are, but you got a good point. A lot of people are now watching television on the portable devices. Tell me your call letters and name, sir. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
QXL. K2RIW from KC2RY. Yeah, I think a lot of people are watching Netflix, videos, and YouTube, and whatever, you know, right on their computers. got an internet box, and he plugged the internet connection into the box. The box connects to the TV through HDMI cable, and you're able to connect. You can select what you want to watch with your remote control, either pay-per-view or for free. Okay, some pretty good information there, David. Your signal is about 50% audio and 50% noise. Lots of bursts of noise coming through, so I think you're in New York City, and any method you can use to aim more signal at the repeater whenever you come back to us would really help, because we're getting an awful lot of noise on your signal. Okay, let's see if Doug had most of his question answered before we move on. So B2RYY. K2RYW on TechNet, you got it, Doug. Oh, wait a minute, yes, the B2SAY, sorry about that. The B2SAY, that Doug. K2RYW, you got it, Doug.
Hey, thanks, Dick. This is WA2SAY. Well, we had talked about capacitors during the week, so I'm not going to bring that up again. I do have another question, however. MFJ makes a graphical antenna analyzer called a 225, which goes up to about 178 megahertz or thereabouts. And they suggest you use an IG-mini-BNA freeware to connect it to your laptop or your computer. My question is, what is the capability of this IG Mini VNA freeware, if anybody is using it? So I would just like to know what its capabilities are. What kind of a display do you get? Do you get, for example, do you get a Smith chart? Can you get a Smith chart out of it?
Let's see if we have anybody with familiarity with that MFJ antenna analyzer with the so-called freeware, which you can download, which hopefully gives you some extra display capability, extra features. Anybody familiar with that freeware and what you get in with using it, please give us your call letters right now. K2RYW, the TechNet, we're listening.
What's the model number?
Repeat that model number, Doug.
Model number of the analyzer is an MFJ-225 graphical antenna analyzer, which has its own little screen on it. But there is also software which you can get download, which I have, I actually have downloaded it, but I don't have one of these analyzers at the moment. So I don't know what its capability is, and that's what I'm asking. If anybody knows the IG-MINI-VNA freeware, if anybody has used that and can tell me what the capabilities of it are, I would be interested.
Yeah, where that software has the tail on it, a VNA, which usually stands for Vector Network Analyzer, I think there's a medium good chance it's going to give you a polar plot, which really would be a Smith chart, and or a rectangular plot. Let's see if Eric has found anything out on that. K2EJ, he's probably looking it up right now. If I know him, he's very fast on his computer. K2RYW in the TechNet.
K2RYW, K2J, yes, you're right. I'm in the process of looking it up. This seems to be an older unit. They're into MFJ-269, it looks like now. But give me another minute. Let me see what I can find here.
Yeah, the software does have the word mini VNA in it. So if it really acts like a vector network analyzer, the majority of vector network analyzer will have either a XY display and or a polar plot technique, and the polar really is Smith chart. It's hard to believe. Everyone thinks a Smith chart is something really magic. It really is a simple polar plot of the reflected signal. You've got a good directional coupler, and you can separate out the reflected signal from the device on the test, and you display it in a polar manner.
reflection is the phase angle of the signal being reflected. So that polar plot is the Smith chart when properly calibrated. As long as you set the outer diameter just right, then it tells you how strong is the standing wave ratio, what is the reflected phase angle, which tells you at the point of measurement whether it appears to be inductive, capacitive, or resistive, or the right combination. Let's see if Eric has found anything. If not, we'll go temporarily over to the next person. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ, I'm finding what I suspect is true. As far as I can see, the MSJs don't have any external connection to a computer. But you did use the word mini-VNA, which I actually happen to have. And that's the real vector network analyzer. Gives you Smith chart, gives you everything. Gives you inductive reactance, capacitive reactance. It gives you SWR, it gives you, what else does it give you? It gives you a whole bunch of things. It's not as good as a VNA that I used just recently to sweep the lines here, but it ain't bad, that's for sure. I'm looking for the word. The most important word is not coming out of my brain. K2RIW, K2J.
If I understand you correctly, Eric, you're concerned that the MFJ-225 antenna analyzer might not have a external connector by which the data from it can be loaded into the mini-VNA downloadable software, in which case you'd have to do that manually, which would be a bit inconvenient. So I'm going to go to Eric and then Doug in that order. Do both of you believe that the older version of antenna analyzer, MFJ-225, might not have that external connector to outload that measured data? K2EJ first, K2RIW, go ahead, Doug.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I'm looking at the latest model, which is the MFJ-269C Pro. And it's like all the similar ones that they've made in the past, where it's basically one meter has SWR, the other meter has impedance, and the word I was looking for before is my VNA is very accurate in terms of determining the term loss. So I have not seen an MFJ, actually let me do one more search for MFJ VNA, let's see if they come up with anything, because I don't think so.
Even if MFJ doesn't call any of their products VNA, if they make the right kind of measurements, return loss in decibels or voltage, return signal in phase angle, then you've got all the raw data to do a VNA function.
I found what he's talking about. The MFJ-226, that gives you, it'll give you a really lousy looking Smith chart. It'll give you S11. It'll give you magnitude, it'll give you the phase, so yeah, it's a real VNA, you know, single port, so it doesn't have its own sweep generator, so you can't do a lot of stuff, but as far as antennas, it'll give you reactance, impedance, return loss, phase angle, and it makes a really awful looking Smith chart.
In other words, his screen is a little bit low in resolution, and the circles, or the hemicircles, semicircles that go on a Smith chart, I think he's saying they look kind of rough and digitized. They got artifacts, they got stepping functions in there. Something else I was going to say about that. Oh, if it doesn't have a built-in sweep generator, then the data you get as a Smith chart will be a single dot on the screen, which represents the impedance of your, the complex impedance of your antenna system at that one frequency.
If you're a sweep, you know, it's going to be able to give you the term loss over the band but that you're looking at. But it doesn't give you the ability to hook a sweep into an antenna and see, or rather into a closed loop and see the response. So, you know, if you were looking to measure an attenuation of your cable, you kind of got to do it single ended.
Okay, so it is a so-called one-port vector network analyzer. A really elaborate vector network analyzer is a two-port. In other words, you're injecting a signal into the device on the test, you're taking a signal out of the device on the test, like an amplifier, and even, in some cases, reversing the procedure, feeding signal into the output, and finding out how much comes out of the input. Therefore, you get all four S parameters, S11, S12, S21, S22. S22, by the way, is output impedance of an amplifier. So a two-port vector network analyzer gives you everything. From my point of view, you get 90% of what you want most of the time with a one-port vector network analyzer. It can inject a sweeping signal into the bottom end of your coax going up to your antenna. That tells you 90% of the time what you want to know. I believe, Eric, KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2IWK2J. No, I agree with you. It says everything that you need to do if you're dealing with antennas and that kind of stuff. The nice thing about the VNA that I have is I can also use it as a signal generator and TDR and a whole bunch of things. So, yeah, my device is a two-port device. This is a single-port device. So, and I'm looking for I'm not noticing any software because it's got a an LCD display which, you know, it shows you the graph on it, so you've got to consider that because it's small, it's going to have some limited resolution. I'm assuming that there may be some software that you can plug into it where it downloads it and gives you better results, but I'm looking at the MFJ page and they don't seem to mention any software that goes with it, but I'm going to look a little deeper. K2RWK2J and 2NBR.
N2, NBR. Please start off with your name, sir, and your information on this subject. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, N2, NBR here. The ham is John, QTH is Northern Westchester. I happen to have a MFJ ham catalog that was produced in 2015, and it contains on page 17 a lot of descriptive information here. And it talks about the MFJ 225, and it they describe it as a graphical antenna analyzer. Goes from 1 to 180 megahertz, and it will do things like SWR, complex impedance, impedance magnitude, return loss, phase from 0 to 180, capacitance up to 9,999. Inductance, 0.1 Henry to 80 microhenry. Cable.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
0 to 30 dB. There's some other stuff here, but maybe you have some other questions.
Very fine, John. You're giving us a lot of good information. The main question right now is does the MFJ 225 contain an output connector by which Doug will be able to use downloadable software into his desktop computer and therefore take the data directly out of his MFJ 225 and apply it to that software and get the display on his great big screen of his desktop computer. Does the catalog give you any information as to whether or not the 225 has that output connector, which I think does exist on the higher class units like the MFA 269. N2, NPR, N2, NBR, K2IW. Wait for the four beeps and you got it, John.
It has two connectors, one for output, one for input. The output is a UHF. Input is hard to tell. It looks like a BNC, but I can't tell from the picture they have here. My something else other than that. My suggestion would be to dial it up on the internet, going through MFJ and see if they talk about computer I don't see it anywhere here as to whether or not you can enter, connect it with a computer. It has graphic charts. It probably has possibility for that.